From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
Resale is growing 25 times faster than traditional retail. So in that way, like, fashion has driven that. And then luxury and tech and other kind of verticals have jumped on that.
I'm Connor Carney, and that's the voice of Sarah Wallett, founder and CEO of Kindora, an online marketplace for buying, selling, and renting premium children's goods. After failing to liquidate some expensive baby equipment online, Sarah realized that there was really no secure one-stop shop in Europe to buy or sell premium resale baby goods. So unlike most normal people who would have given the items away, Sarah went out and launched a startup. 2 years later, Sarah has a co-founder, has raised an angel investment, and has just finished the Techstars Accelerator program in London. And in this conversation, Sarah talks about how she founded the business, her new passion of supporting other women in business, and why you don't need to know, well, anything in order to start or scale a global company. I started off by asking Sarah to tell me about the genesis of Kindora.
Kindora came from the fact that I just wanted to buy a nice handbag, because this was like July 2020, so beginning of the pandemic. I had an 8-month-old baby doom scrolling through Vestiaire Collective, looking at making a wish list of handbags, and found a bag that I liked and wanted to buy. It was like, what can I sell here to kind of fund this? I looked around the room, and the first thing I saw was this little rocker that we bought for my daughter, which was this beautiful French brand called Charlie Crane. It's like a Scandinavian style rocker. It's like a piece of furniture. It's beautiful, but she hadn't sat in it in 2 months. And I was like, that costs the same amount as this bag, so I'm just going to sell that. And I tried to actually sell it through Vestiaire Collective, because they do tend to sell like some homewares and things like that, and they wouldn't accept it. And so I was looking around, and all I could find were my options were really just like Facebook Marketplace, adverts, Gumtree, like really mass marketplaces, and literally nothing about that appealed to me. So it was like, firstly, it's a pandemic. I don't want someone coming to my house and then paying cash and handing something over. Like, none of that worked. A bit disappointed, because I thought, like, these are really special things that we bought for my daughter that were, you know, they were not inexpensive either. And to think about the fact that I have to list them and then it would be like haggling for who wanted to pay the least amount for them, that just didn't feel right either. So when I couldn't find anything that fit the bill, I thought, well, I better ask other people, because I'm surely missing something. Asked around, and then just did a really quick Google Forms set of research questions, and like fired it off to a bunch of mom groups that I'm in, and said, look, can you guys answer this? Because maybe I'm missing something. And if I am missing something, then why hasn't someone built this? And 110 parents later, what became very clear was that there's a whole segment of parents who would like to buy and sell secondhand, really great top quality stuff, didn't like any of those ways to do it, so didn't do it. That these are people who are buying through things like Chrono 24, Vestiaire Collective, StockX, like this is how they were living their lives in other ways. But there was just nothing that accommodated what they were looking for. And the things that they were, like any risks or concerns, were like things around quality of the product, cleanliness, safety. And I thought, well, we could probably solve for those things. So that was the beginning of the idea. So that was July 2020. My co-founder, Barry, came in September 2020 after finding him through advertising on LinkedIn. Because I couldn't, again, pandemic, how am I going to network anyone? Like, it was just impossible. So found him that way. And then we launched our MVP in November. So like from July to November was really working out, what does this look like? Really quickly putting something into the market to test it. And then over the course of a year, iterating and pivoting and figuring out how to refine it. And it's been a really fast-paced journey for us. But what was amazing is like, it's proven that there's a massive demand in the market. Like, we cannot keep up with the demand, and that no one is doing this. So it's like a race to try and do this well as the first ones there.
It does seem strange that no one had done it before. Like, if you think about the components that would make a good marketplace, it's a great niche. There's a lot of high value items that people only want for a certain amount of time, and then they need to get rid of them, and they could probably get some value back. And then on the other side, you know, you've got a lot of people that are growing their families, having babies, and they don't have the money to be able to afford these things brand new. It almost seems like, why had no one looked at it previously?
We're in a very unique moment. So we're at a moment where I think consumer behavior has changed, where the idea of buying well, selling on when you're finished with something, buying the next thing, and really look focusing on quality in resale versus cheap and cheerful, try and flip something to make some cash. That whole thing is evolving, and fashion has led that charge. So for the last 10 years, it's been happening in fashion. And so now it's like, it's pretty mainstream for fashion. Like resale is growing 25 times faster than traditional retail. So in that way, like fashion has driven that. And then luxury and tech and other kind of verticals have jumped on that. This is just a vertical that hasn't done that. And I think there's two things that have kind of stopped it. One is that there were always people doing this in kind of limited ways and limited by geography, right? So like there were lots of people buying up buggies, refurbishing them and selling them on again, but they were limited by a small area because they were using those mass marketplaces. So even through eBay, it still was limited to kind of where you were happy to do shipping and that kind of stuff. And also you were fighting against this idea, which is that like, if you don't buy new, you're not a good parent. We're in a very unique moment where all these things are in flux. We have a chance to challenge quite an old industry. So things like where you used to walk into mother care and one person, one salesperson would basically kit you out with everything you needed for your baby. You know, you drop $5,000 in a go. And that was their business model, right? That it was like one, we just need to get you once. You might come back when your baby was 6 months old and buy the next thing, but we'd already got you for like the first big investment. That's all changing. So the way that people are kind of researching, getting recommendations, they might ultimately buy through like a John Lewis or through a Mamas and Papas or a Baby Bella, but they're looking at like many different sources to validate that before they walk into the shop. And so when the pandemic hit and people were like, well, now I can't go into a shop to buy these things, but I'm still having babies. Then that changed the consumer behavior on the confidence in buying these big items online. So we've just nailed this interesting point to be able to say, let's take this the next step and say, okay, now in a pandemic, space is at a premium. So you're sitting on all this stuff that you might have even bought, like I did, like 6 months earlier. I didn't have room to store all this stuff. It's like just all those factors combine into being able to do this now, which I don't think it could have happened before.
I mean, everyone thinks of these business ideas, they come across opportunities all the time. And, you know, most people wouldn't necessarily act on them. Was it just the right time in your life to do this? You know, what got you to that point?
I have had startups before and I've worked in scale-ups before. At every turn, I said, okay, I'm not doing that again. Like I've done that. Like it was great experience. You work so hard. It is the roller coaster of this is amazing. This is terrible. This is amazing. And I just thought, okay, I've done that. I don't need, like tick the box. Don't need to do it again. It was one of those moments where I thought like, I just can't believe this doesn't exist. Like I said, so like, it was like, I should just give it a try. And it also intersected where I was coming up to the end of my maternity leave and I started my first day back and was made redundant on the day that I came back. And so it was like all those factors, I thought I've got a window here where I can actually really give this a go. And if it's got legs, it'll work. And I can then kind of keep going. If it doesn't, I haven't lost anything and I can find another job. That was in August. And then come November when we launched it and it kind of took off, it really just worked out that way. And I think my background has been kind of evenly split between working in multinational media companies and running internal agencies there that were focused on working with third-party brands to create something new. So that could be anything from when I was at Lonely Planet, I was creating like licensing content for like old school Nokia phones or that kind of stuff for mapping, you know, all kinds of those things, right through to when I worked for CNN and for their kind of group of channels. We built a theme park in Thailand. Like it was just wild, some of the things that I got to work on. And then the other part of my career was working in startups where I was actually taking some of that knowledge and applying it to a very kind of hands-on thing. So I had a startup in Hong Kong for a while, which was around consulting for travel brands and trying to figure out how to help them enter the Asian market. I sold that business. I had a startup that failed, which was an art rental platform, which could absolutely work now. And I would happily go back and try it again. We couldn't get an insurance product to suit us. And so we couldn't get it off the ground properly. And then I moved to New York and I worked with another travel focused business, which was a SaaS product for independent or small group luxury hotels. And the idea was like, it was a SaaS product to extend the reach of the concierge beyond the lobby walls. And so if you're walking around a city and you're staying at a really nice hotel, it's a way to be engaged with the hotel and get recommendations and bookings and that kind of stuff. And so I scaled that up. And so I had both sides of that experience. And I think weirdly, again, I think right time in my life, right time for me professionally, and was willing to take the risk to see if it could work.
How important do you think that experience of working in startups prior to Kindora, how important do you think that was for your current role now?
I don't think I understood the value of it until just recently, to be honest. I think what has become very clear is as we start to get into a place where, you know, we're in rapid growth mode, we have an opportunity that we're trying to really take kind of full hold of. I know that we're not going to make all the right decisions because I've been through that process before, and that's okay. The important thing is that we continue to make decisions. And I think sometimes going from kind of a corporate world into a startup, it's like a culture shock because you have to be very comfortable with risk and with moving fast and also just getting your hands dirty. Like, no one's going to do the work unless you do it. I've seen people in other places where, you know, you might work in a big corporate and you have a really good idea, but then when you go to like actually execute on it, it's so much harder than you realize because you don't have all the supports. So I think that's been really good for me in a way. And I actually also always say to people, I'm so glad I'm doing this. I just turned 40 and I'm really glad that I'm doing this at this point in my life, because I think if I had done this 10 years earlier, I don't think that I would have the same understanding of a couple of things. One is like the value of kind of where you put your energy and how you have to see the return on that. But also the idea that like some things work and some things don't. And I don't get as stressed out about those things as I think I would have in my 20s or 30s, where it's kind of like it was life or death. You know what I mean? Like, oh my God, what am I going to do next? I now know that like some things are going to be great. Some things are not going to work at all. We just have to ride out those kind of ups and downs, and that's going to be fine. So I do think that like all that is really important to me. It's a really important right kind of moment to do that stuff.
So obviously just personal maturity and then having the experience from kind of hands-on experience from previous startups.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you think it makes a difference now, I suppose, being a founder of the startup, the experience and maybe the feeling and motivation and everything, has that played a role at all this time around?
One of the things that I didn't have in my previous startup experiences, but I have in this very clearly, is I can see all the steps that we need to get to. Like, I can see where this can go. The vision is very clear to me of where we can take this business. What's been great is over the course of even the last like 6 months, I would say, those kind of key milestones that I think are very clear to me are getting so much more achievable. And I do think that that is a combination of all those factors I mentioned before, but I also think it's that I'm solving a real life problem. But that's the thing. It's not a vanity thing. It's not like, oh, you know, it's great to go to a stay in a nice hotel and sure, I'd love the concierge to book me dinner and to like have my room service waiting for me every night. That would be amazing. This is actually solving a real life problem that real families face all the time. And so I think that is a really very different experience. So I think that's all a very different kind of set of circumstances, maybe.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
So tell me about raising money, because I know in the last, since launching and everything, you've kind of proved out the model, you've proven that it's a concept that's highly in demand. As you said there, you're now going after this theory as it was initially, very aggressively. Talk to me about the raising money process and how that's gone so far.
I mean, for me, I've been in fundraising teams, I'd never led a fundraise. And so it was like, I jokingly say, it was like, I was learning a new language while I was trying to like write a speech in it. Like it was very, I just had to learn all the time. And I think there were so many great things that happened for me as a part of that. So one was that I was very open about that with people. So I would say to people, like, I've never done this before and I'm learning as I go. So I may not have the terminology all right. I know where I want to get to. Tell me how I should best do that. And it was very much about being like consultative with people and saying, what's the best way to navigate our way to get there?
Do you mean when you're actually in a meeting with a potential investor or just in general? Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Really. Yeah. My approach has been, I'm not going to bluff my way through this. Like, it doesn't make any sense for me. I'm like, I'm just going to make a fool of myself if I try and pretend I know what I'm talking about. And we're not going to get the result that we want anyway. My approach was, it's better for me to say, okay, here's the business. here's where we want to get to. Here's the numbers that stack up for us at the moment. And here's the vision of where we can go. What, as an investor, do you want to see from us to be able to be on the journey with us? Would you help kind of help me figure out how I put this together in a way that is most compelling for an investor and is going to be friendly for me? And I really just workshopped that with as many investors as I could who not all of them came in as investors, but a lot of them kind of gave me just incredibly useful advice and guidance. And I would consider those people still to be a part of our kind of like our wider support network who really want to see the business work. They just weren't ready at that time to be a part of that as an investor. And so we raised a small amount pre-launch from friends and family who liked the idea and were happy to try to see where we could take it. We then raised a kind of angel round before joining the accelerator program that we were in. So we were just completing Techstars London now. And that kind of fueled us to start the steps to look at how do we grow this into a bigger market to show scale. We have an incredible lead investor who is so much more valuable to us than just the investment cash. She's an incredible asset to us. And that has been a huge support for us as well. And it was really through her that we were able to look at what are the right structures for us for investment, for example, to get us to where we need to go and all those types of things. So that was great. As a result, I think we are actually about to close out our oversubscription of our seed of our angel round. So we closed $500,000 going into Techstars in September. On the back of being a part of that network, we had many people who wanted to be a part of the oversubscription. So we're going to close that out. I mean, the reason it stayed open so long is because we keep getting people coming to us and wanting to be a part of it. So we are putting a hard stop on that. I think we've said at this point, the 10th of December, because we'll close that out at the end of Techstars. We have our demo day actually on the 5th of December. So once that happens, we'll be able to, that will essentially go up wider to hundreds more potential investors. We'll close that out in December. And then really all focus for us goes on kind of launching in the UK strongly and then like getting ourselves match fit for our seed round. Because from our perspective, the key thing for us is speed. So we have to move very quickly to kind of get a foothold in the market and to do things well so we can start to change kind of behaviors. There are certain seasonalities that fall into this business. So most babies in the UK and Europe are born in September and October. People find out they're having a baby in kind of late January, early February. April until July is like peak buying time for all the big investment pieces that you need. So we need to be fully in the UK market to be able to capture as much of that market share as we can in that kind of April to July time, and then raise our seed round at the same time so that we can spend the second part of the year building and kind of investing in what we need to do to then capture those 2023 parents who are coming into the market with even more growth and kind of the best possible product for them. So that's really the timing for us that will come into play every single year while we're in Europe. And we'll be closing that kind of window to say like, okay, we're going to age up and do all kinds of things. But from a fundraising perspective, it puts some pressure on us. So, and I would never have been able to have confidence in doing any of this stuff had we not just kind of used this experience to learn as much as possible and to just, fine tune how we talk to potential investors, I think.
How do you think you've gotten such a good grasp of the overall market for this? And look, we've talked about your prior experience with startups, but I mean, I suppose this is the first time in this particular vertical that you've ever been involved in a business. How has that learning curve been? Because, and I know your approach with investors was to say that you didn't know a lot, but clearly, you know, from talking to you, it comes across that you do know quite a lot about this market. I mean, even seasonality, I would never know that there's seasonality I just assume that babies are born all year round. Yeah. You know, how did these things come about? How were you able to figure this out? And I'm sure it's given you a lot of credibility when having those conversations with investors.
It's a combination of factors. Like I certainly, none of us in the business have experience in this particular vertical. That's the first thing. And so I think that's an advantage, to be quite frank. I think that we've been able to come into this with a very different lens, and the nursery and kids items like industry is, you know, I think there are some great innovative players in it, but as a general rule, I think it is pretty old school in the way that it works. And so I think that across the industry, they know that innovation has got to happen, right? They know that. But I think that there's a bit of a fear around like there's some older models and markets or brands that dominate the market, they don't really think that they need to change, or they're afraid of change. The kind of more innovative ones who are really kind of jumping on the idea of how do we do things differently are nailing it, but they are the outliers. So I think we have an opportunity to be like this really nice, supportive kind of platform that says to those brands that are like unsure of how to do this, we're going to take you through it. Like, we're going to be your help through it. You don't have to do it alone. And your peers are in it with you, right? That's a really important thing. So we can say that as outsiders. It's hard to do it from inside. But I think to get there, we've had to like learn all the time. Like, it's continuously researching, asking the questions. I have no, like, I went to like a my first kind of industry trade show in September. And I have no problem with saying to people, I have no idea how this works. Like, tell me how this works, because I'm not like, assume I know nothing. And what happens? And like, and people are very happy to share information, which I think is great. But it's really about like just being able to ask as many questions as possible. And then I think within that also, you start, maybe because I'm not in the industry, I hear things differently than someone who's in the industry. So when I'm at this trade show, and I walked into this conference center in Harrogate in Yorkshire, and literally like every brand had this amazing booth to display all of their items, right? And so there's probably £500,000 worth of amazing products sitting in these amazing booths. And then I hear from all of them, well, so at the end of the day, this is a trade show, we have to pack up all the stuff and bring it back to our showrooms or wherever else. And they hate it. They hate the idea that they have to do that. So we were like, well, why don't we just sell all this stuff for you? Because we can just collect it all, send it all to our warehouse, sell it, and then you get cash, you get kind of capital unlocked from it. And then, because all that stuff that's been opened out of a box, they can't sell as new anyway. So it's like solving these problems for them in ways that maybe they just haven't been really thought about before. It leads us to kind of then being to learning more about how we can pivot our business as well. So I guess in a way, kind of advice that I would give anyone is like, I wouldn't worry too much. You can learn a lot more about things. I think those are learnable things. I think it's more about like your vision or your approach or your solutions, your problem solving is what's going to be the critical part. You can learn the language. You can learn the kind of ins and outs. I think it's more like always asking yourself, like, are you solving a problem here? And if you're solving a problem, people are going to work with you. Like, that's the way we found it.
Coming from that place, and I suppose this feeds into your approach with investors as well. There's an honesty to it in that I don't really know, but I think there's something here, and this is the way I want to go. You can advise me in what you think is best, but this is kind of where we're going.
Yeah.
That must have helped not only with it's probably helped with customers, and it's probably helped in terms of your conversations with investors, because the more I speak to people through this podcast and through JetBooks, the more I speak to kind of business owners, entrepreneurs. You know, no one really knows. I think if you were to pick, you know, the top 10 business people in the world and ask them is what they have now, what they initially planned from the very, very start, I don't think they'd say yes in that respect. Yeah. Do you think it's helped?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I think there's power in it. I think that experience and age have brought that to me. So like, I do think that like, I don't worry about looking like I don't know what I'm doing at this point, because I think there's a power in being able to say, look, I know my business, like I know what's happening in my business, but I don't necessarily have all the answers to everything. So as a business, we always bring in resource that know more than we do. And so we've just done that with a couple of people. We've just brought in a product lead who's ex-eBay. We've just brought in a UX kind of audit from a guy who's working on a number of e-commerce, like the best e-commerce sites in the world, to be able to kind of do that for us, because we don't know the answers to those questions. And I think when it comes to investment, one of the things that we do know is kind of the types of investors that we want to work with. So we weed that out quite quickly. And I think the investors we want to work with come at problems the same way that we do, which is that we might not know all the answers, but we're going to figure out some ways to kind of solve for the problem or test the potential solution. And that's okay. So some of the questions that now going into our seed round, and we're talking to VCs, we haven't had any institutional funding to this point. We're talking to institutional investors now. The first two questions I ask everyone is, talk to me about who your female decision makers are in your fund, because I think it's really important that we have a variety of viewpoints in any partner in any fund that we work with. I don't think it's the best course of action for us to have all the same type of people thinking the same way. that's just not also what families look like. So we want to make sure that that's reflected. I also always ask, what is your strategy for female founders? Because I think it's very important that even if they don't have one, that they're able to say to me, we don't have one, but we either want to work with more female founders and we're actively looking for them, or, you know, we just don't have any female founders and point blank, that's it. I think just being like as clear as possible is helpful. And the third thing I always say is like, are you guys nice people? Because I don't want to work with people who aren't like, I'm going to have to talk to you like weekly, if not daily at some points. If I don't talk to you and you're not nice to work with, and it's not like a relationship that I really like, can't wait to like give you news or tell you problems and whatever else, it's not going to work. So I think that has weeded out a lot of misalignment that we would have for us so far already.
Is it something you think about a lot, the female side of things and diversity within business? Is that a big part of what you're doing now?
Look, if you had asked me this 3 or 4 years ago, I absolutely would not have said yes. I would have said, sure, like that sounds like a good thing, but I wouldn't have been like, yeah, I'm really passionate about it. I'd say in the last 12 months, it has been such a shocking kind of learning curve to see really what happens. And like, and I've talked about this a lot, but like there's some key things that I think are really, in the Irish context, are really, really disappointing. But also I think in the global context, like in the Irish context, I think there is potentially, like they're missing a trick here around there's a big focus on B2B startups. Like no one really is focusing, very few consumer focused startups are getting attention or kind of funding that they should be getting to test out their ideas. It's all going to really big B2B solutions. Majority of those are driven by men, which is a real shame, because I think that's like, we're seeing investment in more of the same all the time. Sure, there's some proof that like, yep, those are good investments to make. There's more proof that actually women are a better bet when it comes to return. So like there's just a lack of that. And I always say like, I mean, we managed to get funding from amazing angels because we were able to find the right people to talk to. That was not easy, but it also is much harder for people in other circumstances. Like if I'm, you know, a 20-year-old first generation immigrant, and I have a great idea, it's much harder for me to get even in front of the right people to get funding, to get this kind of idea off the ground. So I think it's for me less about women and more about more viewpoints and more about like, why just have white men leading B2B businesses? Like that's good, but there's way more out there, and we're going to miss out on that stuff. We're also solving problems that I don't think are, if you're not in them, you're not aware of their problems. I spoke at Web Summit, and one of the things I was really surprised at was, I think the stat was something like half the attendees were women. I don't think half the speakers were women, but I could be wrong on that. What was very clear to me was there was a lack of like, I saw maybe one or two people who might be in a wheelchair, you know, in terms of just like, there are people out there who are living their lives every day with challenges that no one else, like that we don't have as average people. So why are we ignoring the opportunity for these amazing founders and kind of people of good ideas that just may not be what is your experience? Like we should be really seeking those people out. I am passionate about that. I think that's a very important thing to raise. If I have a platform to raise it, I will raise it, because I think the world's missing out if we don't do that.
I know you spent some time, you said earlier, in the States, and we were talking there about if you're a first generation immigrant, it must be much harder. I would say that's particularly difficult in somewhere like Ireland, where a lot of things are relationship focused in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And I think coming, like, I'm from Canada, I'm not Irish, I've been here for 3 years. I don't have a network that say someone who grew up here did. Although that wasn't that hard for me to overcome, quite frankly, right? So I was very, just by circumstance, I'm kind of lucky to be able to do that. We're missing out on amazing ideas. Like we're missing them out on like super creative, innovative ideas just because it's not your lived experience. And I really, like, I champion the idea that like, let's really find those people who have ideas and are solving problems that you might not even have, but like a huge part of the world does. So let's find those people.
What's been the most difficult thing for you, do you think, since launching the business or even since beforehand? What have you really struggled with?
You know, we're working in a vertical that is very focused on women. And so we've had some kind of disappointing experiences when it comes to talking to like some male investors who may not understand the scale or the opportunity of what we're talking about. Parents, I find that really challenging, where I'm like, you know, okay, this has a lot about what's going on here. So I think that we've had experiences where as a female founder, you get these weird comments. Like, I've definitely had the comment like, it's, you know, nice girl, nice idea. Okay. I don't like the terms like we did, you know, sometimes you get labeled like mumtrepreneur and all that kind of stuff. And I just think that is just, it's a power play. And I just don't understand that doesn't even need to be in like the lexicon. But I think more than anything, it's that like, if we were doing the same idea, but I was talking about golf clubs, or I was talking about bikes, or I was talking about something that was less focused on women, I think we would have had more support and traction. I really firmly believe that. And quite frankly, for us as a business, I have had, you know, I probably shoot myself in the foot by saying this whenever I talk to people, but we've had no support from people like Enterprise Ireland. We've had no support from the local enterprise office. We've had not one government program has supported us. And we've applied to the NDRC program for their accelerator program. We didn't make it past the second interview there. And in the same week that we were turned down for the NDRC accelerator program, we were accepted into Techstars London. And so what it said to me was, if we were to stay within the Irish context of trying to grow this business from Irish kind of supports and that kind of thing, it was never going to happen. Like, we would never have got this business off the ground. Instead, getting outside of this market and being able to like really think about more broadly across, and Techstars, because it's an American founded organization with lots of exposure to the US, lots of exposure across Europe, that has supercharged us. So I think that has been a really disappointing learning, actually. I really didn't expect that we wouldn't. I thought when we started this, that we ticked a lot of boxes. We have a business that is focused on sustainability. We are a female-led business. We are essentially kind of then, we were building jobs. We were looking at all kinds of things, and it just couldn't get attention. And to this day, I've never been approached by anyone from Enterprise Ireland. So I don't know if I'm on a blacklist or what, but it's just a shame. You know, we'd love to do more within Ireland and to like, you know, figure this out. But I think it's looking like we're going to be focused much more on, you know, other markets, really.
Well, I think in your case, it's a bit of a land grab opportunity. You know, you're trying to get as far as you can, as quick as you can. In that case, maybe some more private funding and having the kind of more VC environment rather than the kind of government support environment might suit you a little bit better in any case.
We've been able to move very fast because of the structures of our investments as well. We have amazing people who've become a part of our kind of journey. So I'm thrilled with how it's all turned out. I would love in the future to be able to work with Enterprise Ireland as we grow into other markets. I mean, we're an Irish business scaling fast into multiple markets. By the end of 2023, we will be in 15 markets. We would love to have them on that journey with us. And hopefully that is something that happens. We were just disappointed that vision wasn't really understood from the beginning. And we didn't tick the box of being B2B kind of like very safe. We were kind of thinking outside the box, which is not necessarily their line. So
tell me about Techstars then, because I know you're coming to the end of that process now. How did you apply? What's the experience been like to date? And how do you kind of hope things end up with that?
It was a great experience for us, full stop. It was, we were the only Irish business. There's another business in there that's led by an Irish guy, but we're the only Irish business in it. The cohort we were in is incredible. So there's 11 other businesses in our group, huge variety across the board. Like, I think just having that peer set was really, really helpful for us to kind of keep us. I think doing a business like this in a pandemic has been kind of a lonely existence for us. And so to have a whole bunch of people who are going through the same thing, even though it's very different businesses, great, absolutely great. The network and the group, the program itself, hugely valuable. I think our challenge was that we were running a business that was live while we were doing it. So that was like two full-time gigs. Like, I don't know how I'm not like fully gray, like Obama went gray in his 8 years in office. Like, that's kind of where I should be right now in my grayness. But that was the only kind of tip that I've told people is like, apply as early as you feel comfortable in your business journey, because you're going to get a lot more out of it early on before you go fully live. Like, we got a lot out of it anyway, but that was a big thing. Access to amazing, amazing mentors. So as a result of Techstars, we have mentors who are like ex-Disney, ex-McDonald's, ex-eBay, Amazon. One of our lead mentors is the CMO of Trini London, an amazing kind of digital grown makeup brand, which is just skyrocketing. And people like that are invaluable. We would never have got that access before. I got to speak at Web Summit because of Techstars on the main stage. Hugely, hugely valuable. I would do it again. The funding we got from them was very helpful for us as well. So that was a great kind of shot in the arm. there was no downside for us, none at all. And they're doing actually, I think Techstars London is now running 2 programs a year. So starting from next year. So I think there's actually applications open now for the spring cohort. So I would encourage anyone who's interested to apply. We literally found out about it 2 weeks before the deadline closed. We applied and we had 2 interviews and we made it through. And I think what they champion are really innovative founders who have the kind of ability to try something. So even if the idea fails, they back people. And we love that. So it really works for us.
For people who might not know what Techstars is, it's a accelerator, incubator. They give you access to obviously mentors you've talked about. Is there coaching or training or sessions? What way is this kind of set up on a daily basis?
They condense their accelerator program. A lot of like the NDRC, for example, is 6 months. Techstars is 3 months. It's condensed. So it is intense, but you go through. So for example, we did, I want to say it was probably 3 weeks of what they call Mentor Madness. And it's basically speed dating with like 80 different mentors who you get access to. And as a result of that, you kind of get matched up with a bunch of people who align with you to help you kind of get your business in ship shape. We also have like essentially like a mini MBA that you do throughout it. And it covers everything from finance to PR, to brand building, to sales tactics, everything you can imagine. And it is led by like absolute industry leaders. So you do, and it is like private. So it is, you're kind of 11 other companies and you who are doing this. So it's very, you just get like this one-on-one attention all the time. It's really great. The network itself, it's like Techstars has been around for 15 years. It's a US founded organization. There are 15,000 plus companies who've gone through it. I would say it is like, you have access to that entire network for your entire journey, like beyond, like as long as you want to have access. And they have a real ethos around ask and give all the time. So like ask for anything you need, you're going to get responses, you're going to get help that you're expected to also give back and to help others who need in the organization. And I just think personally for me, I really found it really, just great. I've loved it.
Can you point to anything specifically that you've taken from it? Any bit of advice or just any inspirations or realizations that you've had throughout the 3 months?
It's changed. So we came into that business, or came into the accelerator with this idea that we were going to just scale up geographically our business. That's how we were going to grow. I'm coming out the other end of it now with a very different view. So we're actually pivoting slightly to like, our view is like in the next 12 months, we can become a fintech for families. So that's a very different position to be in than we were when we started. And we have not only kind of worked and workshopped through that idea and how we're going to make this work within that context of Techstars, but we've also come out the other end with like a very clear set of who do we need to get to, who should be our investors to make that happen? What are the skill sets we need in the business to make that happen? What are the milestones and kind of commercial points we need to hit to be able to fuel that to make it work? We got our business to a place in 3 months where we would have probably got to organically in 12 months. So that was a huge value for us. So we're coming out with a very different product focus, a commercial focus. Our pitch has been refined. Our network has grown. Our confidence has grown as well. Like, I think that's been a huge thing for us. And so we just have more in our tool belt to use as we go into this next phase.
That sounds really interesting, actually. So is it a big change internally? Maybe it feels like a bigger change than it is. But in terms of the product and everything, this kind of marketplace for, let's say, secondhand baby items and kind of high value baby items versus, you know, fintech for families. Is it the messaging that's changing, or is there anything happening under the hood that's?
Yeah, you actually took the words out. I always talk about the idea that like we are on the surface, we are this kind of very premium marketplace, which is getting even more premium actually. So we're leaning into that even further. And I think that's the confidence piece that's letting us do that. And that's exciting. But I think it's under the hood, we're actually, from a product build, we're changing some of the infrastructure. So within 12 months, when you come onto Kondora, you'll be able to have essentially a wallet function that shows you what you've spent, saved, earned, donated, and the sustainability metrics around your entire journey with Kondora. That's at a basic level. The next layer of that is services of banking. So like buy now, pay later, loyalty, you know, premium memberships, like all kinds of things that fall into that, that essentially will help families spend their budget differently, give them solutions to how they can manage that money and those funds in a different way. allow them access to tools they wouldn't have had. So like you're kind of limited whether you're using your banking partner or whoever else to buy stuff. So this is all a part now of our strategy. I don't think we would have got there fast enough if we had just done it on our own. And then leaning into the organic or the premium thing. I mean, we're really now leaning into this idea of kind of the same way that you buy a certified pre-owned car. And you buy it through a dealer who you know has used the right parts to service it, and there's service logs and all those things. So it's the best option to buying new that you have. Exactly the same ethos when it comes to kids' goods. So we're working with all the brands and then their service partners to say, look, all like a great buggy, we'll get it safety checked, refurbed if it needs to be cleaned, and there'll be a condition report with everything, and it will have a stamp of approval. So yes, you might pay more for that secondhand buggy, but we've de-risked the entire purchase. And so that at scale doesn't exist anywhere. So that's where we're like, we can really start to pinpoint how to do this better, how to do it more efficiently, how to do it more driven by product rather than people. Like there's just so much that's going into this now where it's a different business, really.
And I suppose what you were already doing in a way was a financial product. You know, you're allowing people to make money from things that they might have tied up in baby equipment that they're not using anymore. And on the other side, obviously, you're getting people that are that want to buy these things for much less, and you're giving them an avenue to do that. It's just, I suppose, opening up all the ways in which you could finance these high value items is, I suppose, what you're doing now. Would that be fair to say?
It's opening that up, but it's also saying, look, for a lot of people, like this buggy's taking up space in my house. It's not about the money for me. It's like, this is a good thing. Yeah, I'd like to unlock some cash from it. Great. But more than anything, I want to get it out of my house. I need the space and someone else could use it. Right. So what we're facilitating are things like donation. Like it's very hard to donate a product at the moment for baby goods. But if we can sell that product for you, you can donate the proceeds or part of the proceeds of that. And we'll facilitate that transaction as well. It's about being able to track, like I've spent this much, but I've saved this much because it's a secondhand. The way that I've bought it has saved on the retail price. I've been able to earn back this much. So I'm kind of being able to essentially track consistently, like, where are my funds going? How have I managed them? Could I rent something rather than buy it, for example, so that my outgoings are less? Like all of the giving people the we always say, we want to empower families rather than kind of just give them like quick solutions. Like, let's just empower them in a way that currently they're not able to do. And you're currently still just spending on stuff, right? So it is just about, it is costly to have a baby. So if we can find a way, you're still going to want the best stuff. You don't want to compromise on safety. We understand all that. And we also know Kendora is not for everyone, right? We are open to all families of all shapes and sizes. But for some people, these are still expensive things they're not going to be able to buy through us. We get that. There are lots of other ways to buy secondhand. We really, like, where there's room for everyone in that ecosystem. We are the premium market for that. And our goal is really to say, you know, there is a really elegant, very nice way to do this stuff. And we're going to empower you to then be able to see how you're spending and earning and donating. And then further on, there'll be all kinds of other products that will be able to be a part of that. So maybe it's like you're selling this stuff and saving for your child's education fund or whatever it might be. Like these are all ways we can see this moving.
Tell me about how you see the future developing now. We've said you're ambitious, but I suppose we haven't put a number or anything around that, and we don't have to. But where do you see this going over the next 3, 5, 10 years? And where would you like to be in 10 years' time?
So we know that resale is the future. We know that. And it's not just resale of used goods. It's like, how do we take the stuff that we've already manufactured and make sure that it gets the longest life. And that includes things that have been returned and things like that. So this is a €1 billion opportunity for sure in Europe. And we want to tackle that. So we see that within the next, within 10 years, this is €1 billion business. We see this aging up. So like a baby born today should be able to get everything they need through Kendora until they're 10. That's an easy one that we think we can do. Certainly growing across Europe and then growing into markets where birth rates are going up. So looking at where we can make an impact on where populations are growing and we can start to help them have a smaller footprint on everything. The technology that we're developing, I didn't even get into some of the other things we're doing, is easily picked up and applied to other sectors. So we certainly see that happening. So there are a number of different kind of B2B solutions we're building here that can be white labeled and used across other industries. There's solving for the parents of the next generation who would expect this to be there for them, and that we, that would be a global play for us. And then scaling up so that, you know, the teenagers of the next generation are going into being teenagers and kind of 20 somethings with a way smaller impact on the world they're going to live in from their childhood years. I mean, my child today will be appalled when she knows about how much waste she's generated even in her 2 years of life. So I genuinely think we can make a difference so that parents in the next generation don't have to have that really difficult conversation with a teenager and say, oh yeah, you know, this is your actual debt on the planet already. We're going to help you make that way less and hopefully eliminate it.
So Sarah, where can people find out more about Kindora, whether from a customer or an investor perspective? Where do you recommend they go?
Kindora.shop is our European website. Kindora.co.uk is our UK website. You can find everything there. You can contact all of Kindora at hello@kindora.shop. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're everywhere. LinkedIn is where we're doing a lot of kind of the work around our business itself. So feel free to contact me through LinkedIn, follow us as a business, and you'll hear lots more about us in the coming, I would say, few months. It's a very exciting time.
Well, Sarah, we wish you the very best of luck. It's a great story so far, and we're looking forward to seeing the rest of it over the next couple of years. Sarah Wallet, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks, Connor.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.